From the studios of KPCW in Park City, it's This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about the environment and our connections with it. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak. In Mark Sundin's book, The Unsettlers, In Search of the Good Life in Today's America, three American families ditch modern comforts and convenience, including, in some cases, supermarkets, cars, and even electricity, to define authentic living for themselves.
For those striving to live a simpler, uncomplicated life, The Unsettlers offers an in-depth and compelling account of diverse Americans living off the grid, both physically and behaviorally.
In each of the book's three sections, Missouri, Detroit, and Montana, these homesteaders show us how it's possible to live a life that is fulfilling, largely due to the fact that they demand less of the planet.
The author Mark Sundin is coming to Park City as part of the Utah Humanities Book Festival. He'll be discussing his book, The Unsettlers, along with his other works, this Saturday the 23rd at the Jim Santee Auditorium. He joins us in the first part of the show.
And speaking of unsettling, we're going to have some news items in the second half of the show, one of which covers the Hurricane Irma, and the devastation it did, across the Caribbean, but in respect to the Keys. And we're going to look at some of the environmental damage associated with that. What else do we have, Mel?
That's right. We've got an update on the status of the national monuments that were being reviewed by Zinke. And we'll talk a little bit about what he's recommending to Trump.
Yeah, four. At least four that are going to change in size, and maybe another six in operational management. We'll give you the details on that. And then a little details about your trip back east.
That's right. Back to the Adirondacks in upstate New York.
Some research you did there?
That's right. On the ground research in upstate New York on assignment.
All right. Remember, we don't take phone calls during the show, but you can join in on today's discussion by posting your comments and questions to our Facebook page, KPCW, This Green Earth. Our connections with and impacts upon the environment, that's what This Green Earth is all about. Stay with us.
This is Steve Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties. We continue to be proud supporters of KPCW, our local source for Park City news. Our agents are Summit and Wasatch County's source for real estate, and we can be reached at bhhsutah.com.
Welcome to This Green Earth, a weekly talk show about environmental issues and concepts of sustainability. Joining us on the phone is our guest for the first part of the show. He's Mark Sundin. He's the author of several books, most recently the book titled The Unsettlers, In Search of the Good Life in Today's America. A story, let Mark tell about what the book's about. Mark, thanks for joining Nell and myself this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, let's start here. Why don't you give the audience just a little thumbnail sketch about what this book, The Unsettlers, is about.
Well, this is a book about three families who have tried to break free from the global economy. So part of that might be living off the grid in terms of being on solar or not using electricity at all. But more than that, it was just a deep examination of where their money came from and where it went. And which part of the, basically they're trying to boycott a lot of the systems that feel often like they're trying to destroy us. So I guess four examples would be agriculture or industrial agriculture, the fossil fuel industry, and banking. And there's a little bit in there about taxation as well. But they've been trying to find new systems to avoid using those ones.
Okay. And so you focus on three couples, one each in the states of Missouri, Detroit, and Montana. Let's just go through one at a time. Let's start with, the couple in Missouri. Who are they? What
sure.
did they do? Yeah.
Sure. The names are Ethan and Sarah. And they were, at one point, maybe back in the 90s, they were pretty... I guess you'd call them environmental activists, and they didn't feel like the political movement was doing enough in terms of managing its own consumption. And so they decided to move to France. They lived on a Gandhian community without electricity, where they grew all their own food, where they didn't pay any taxes. They were what they call war tax resistors. And then about 10 years ago, they decided to start a similar community in Missouri. So they're in a little town called La Plata. They've got an 80-acre Amish farm, and they don't use any electricity. They don't use cars, but they only use bikes or public transportation to get around. Grow all their own food, and they don't work on the cash economy. They get some donations from visitors. They have 1,500 visitors a year who come to take classes in nonviolence or in permaculture or natural building. And they have been doing this now with two children for 10 years now, and it's been an amazing success.
It's so interesting that you mentioned it was, you know, in an Amish farm. Chris and I were talking to each other before the show and wondering how many other people out there beyond the three groups that you feature are doing this kind of thing. Do you have any sense of that?
It's really hard to get a number because most of the people doing this are in a place they can't be counted. They don't they don't participate in them. They don't have blogs. They don't a lot of them don't vote. So it's really hard to say. I mean, people living as radically and as simply as Sarah and Ethan are very rare. So I would say the total number would be in the thousands across the entire country. But you know, like you said, you mentioned the Amish. There are people who were born into this tradition and live this way. But my book doesn't really cover the Amish or the Hutterites or the Mennonites because I wanted to write about people who had been born into mainstream civilization and then chosen to leave it for ethical reasons and start something new.
Okay, so that's the Missouri couple. Let's take a turn and go to Detroit because that's an interesting profile of an urban-based unsettlers.
Yeah, the more I studied the people living in sort of the rural America, I started to feel that in some instances, not with Ethan and Sarah, but in other instances, there was people were just kind of avoiding problems rather than solving them. So what I mean by that is you could have a beautiful off-the-grid home up in the mountains and feel like you are sort of solved some problems, but if you're still tied into the global economy, whether that means by telecommuting or selling stock online or driving 40 or 50 miles a day to go work at a bank, you're still part of that system. And when I looked at the real problems of climate change and of economic catastrophe, I saw that the apocalypse wasn't something that was going to happen in the future, but rather it's something that's already happened in New Orleans, of course, and then in Detroit. And when it does happen, the people who are victims are not white middle-class folks who've taken a permaculture class. They tend to be poor people of color. And so I was wondering, well, how did they manage to survive these cataclysmic events? And so when I went to Detroit, I found that actually there was an incredible movement flowering amidst all of the wreckage and the, you know, destroyed buildings and homes. And it was led mostly by African-Americans who were from Detroit. And it was all about local farming, sustainability, and also building black business that would be resilient to the ups and downs of the corporate economy. So this family there, Olivia is a woman, and she's black, and she's from Detroit. Her husband is Greg. He's white. He's from the suburbs. They basically have a homestead on abandoned lots in downtown Detroit. And for the past 5 or 6 years, they've been able to make a living as farmers, just selling at the farmer's market. They have a CSA. And they've been really conscientious about not accepting any funding from institutions or the government or universities because they want to show that, that it can be done. And they also don't want to be dependent on, you know, these sort of big donations for their livelihood.
So they're you say they're making money, growing their own food, correct, selling their own food. And they, I guess, obviously they live in a relatively small homestead or so, but it's in the middle of the city.
Yeah, they have an old house that I think was built in the 1890s. And, you know, you can buy these houses for, I think they paid $15,000 for their house. And, you know, it needs a lot of work. But, they, you know, they didn't want to go into debt, and they didn't want to go live in the suburbs and then be dependent on cars and freeways and petroleum products. So they've decided to do everything local. And for the most part, they sell all of their groceries within, or they sell all their vegetables within a few minutes of their house.
And they refuse to sell to Whole Foods, is that right?
Yeah, they had an offer. You know, so Detroit, even though it's still pretty bankrupt, it's had some pockets of gentrification, and Whole Foods came in and started a store just about 2 or 3 miles from Greg and Olivia's house. And they reached out to a lot of local businesses in a way that was really applauded by a lot of people in the food justice movement. But for Greg and Olivia, they just didn't want to be a part of that system of providing profits for a corporation that was based out of state. And so they refused to sell their lettuce to Whole Foods. It was sort of one of their many lines in the sand that they drew.
Interesting.
So it's such an interesting story. How do Olivia and Greg, people who are from, you know, urban Detroit and the suburbs, how do they end up running an urban farm? Like, what is the path that they took to get there?
It's pretty circuitous. Greg was a public school teacher for about 15 years, and he just kind of started growing vegetables in his backyard and kind of caught the bug, you might say. And because he was surrounded by all these vacant lots, he just started sort of taking them over one by one and growing more and more food. But he was certainly not trained as a as a farmer and didn't come from a farm background. Olivia actually had majored in horticulture and had had an internship in England at the Royal Gardens, and then she'd had a job as a horticulturalist at a conservatory of a botanical conservatory there in Detroit. So she really knew what she was doing. And when they got together, she sort of whipped the place into shape and put a little more scientific method into what they were doing. But a lot of it is self-taught. I mean, you know, they're dealing with problems that most farmers don't ever deal with. Like, you know, they have potentially toxic rubble in these lots that they have to remove, or they have crack house across the street and they have people hiding out in their fields from the police.
Jeez.
Or they're trying to gather compost, and so they're trying to get it from the zoo or from the coffee roasters or from the breweries, and they're trying to make do with what they have so they don't have to order soil or order any kind of fertilizers and have them shipped in from across the country.
We're speaking with Mark Sundin. He's the author of the book, The Unsettlers, In Search of the Good Life in Today's America. Mark is actually coming to Park City this weekend to talk about his book and other works of his, which actually I want to get to the one book in particular, The Man Who Quit Money. Mark's going to be at the Jim Santee Auditorium this Saturday, the 23rd. I believe it's at 6 p.m. I'll have to check the details on that. This is all part of the Utah Humanities Books Festival going on this month throughout the state of Utah. So, Mark, let's just to finish full circle here, let's talk about the couple in Montana. What are they about? What have they done?
Yes, Steve and Lucy are organic farmers who have been doing it since the early 80s, and they were really pioneers in terms of innovating what could be grown in that climate, and convincing an entire city in the western part of Montana to change their eating habits to go organic and local and sustainable. But what was most interesting to me about them is that they have actually succeeded. You know, 30 years later, they own 80 acres. You know, when they started out, they were living in a teepee, and they were renting, and their first kid was born in a teepee in a home birth. And now, you know, they've got 80 acres, they've got a house, they use cars, they use tractors. And so in some sense, they're not, in every sense, they're not off the grid anymore. But what they showed was what it would take to scale up, to really try to transform society and without actually compromising your belief. And I think they've succeeded in that. The other thing that interested me about them was that their kids are now college age, and you know, their kids don't want to be farmers. They've grown up on this beautiful, what I call, worktopia, where they were kind of sheltered from a lot of consumerism and from junk food, and their kids didn't want to be farmers. So now this family is dealing with, well, how do we pass these values on to our kids, and what are we going to do with this beautiful farm we've created?
I can only imagine it's a challenging task to raise children on a semi, you know, off the grid setting.
Right, surrounded by a very attached world.
Yeah, the family doesn't. They didn't have television. They didn't have the internet, of course. But when the kids were in high school, they had to use computers, and so. And the parents are like, well, we're not going to buy computers because we don't think that they're necessary. So the kids were able to grow their own crop and with the proceeds that they made from that, buy their own laptops. And then when they wanted to use Wi-Fi, they would get in the tractor and raise up the seat, and then they would poach the Wi-Fi from their neighbors.
I could see why that perhaps gets a little tiring after a while. You know,
right.
Surrounded by,
again. There was a great story that when the oldest son moved to New York City, he was moving into an apartment. It was after dark. It was kind of a sketchy neighborhood. And he got the key from the realtor. And as he was trying to open the door, he realized he had never opened the door with a key in his whole life.
His
house had never been locked.
Wow.
That's off the grid. Yeah,
it is.
Way off.
Yeah, yeah.
So one thread that seems to run throughout all three of these is that this is not like an easy lifestyle. This is a lot of work. And so it's not, I guess, too surprising to me to hear that kids are saying like, yeah, I mean, sure, maybe this was a great way to grow up, but I don't know if I can hack it. So what's the attitude about all of that work, you know, amongst these families?
Well, I guess the most important thing is they love the work. These are not people who are suffering just to make the rest of us feel bad. But, you know, they love the activism. They love the physical work. They love being outside. They love being their own boss. They love the freedom that comes with it. And they're willing to accept the physical difficulty of it. You know, but I think that, you know, to a lot of people, that's actually appealing. Because so many of us sit inside and look at screens all day and maybe question the worth of the work we do. Maybe it just feels like we're manipulating numbers on a screen. And these people get a real satisfaction from growing food, from building their own houses, from, you know, figuring out how the world works and figuring out what work needs to be done. And I guess a deeper philosophical take on all of this work is that I would say these families believe that by sort of embracing one type of limitations, they find a deeper abundance. So by giving up electricity or the internet or packaged food, all of these things which have made life supposedly easier, they find a deeper sense of purpose in what they do.
So maybe you just partially answered this question, but I wanted to ask, what was the motivation behind, you know, choosing these this way of life for these people? With one couple, you mentioned that they had been environmental activists. So does this come from an environmental standpoint, an economic standpoint? What's the motivator?
Yeah, I would say that a lot of them were drawn in by the environmental angle of trying to waste less and use less poisons in their daily life. But once they got into it, you know, I think they all realized that the so-called environmental causes were really tied in with social justice and racial justice causes. And the two things became hard to tease apart. So, I mean, one of the things that I learned in writing this book was that by and large, the corporations and the powers that are destroying nature are the same ones that are exploiting vulnerable people, usually people who have brown skin. And so the fight against those powers is really one and the same.
After seeing the way that, you know, these people live, is this, like, tempting to you? Are you ready to, like, give this a try on your own?
You know, I was actually, when I was writing the book, I was probably living more closely to this way than I am now. My wife and I were up in Montana, and we lived on an old farmhouse and had a very big garden, and we were surrounded by acres and acres of wild lands with wild animals running through. At the moment, we're living in Albuquerque, and I'm teaching at the University of New Mexico, so we've kind of made a sharp turn to a more urban, conventional life, I guess. But, I guess one of the things that I learned in the process of writing this book was that these families were doing work that they loved. Mm-hmm. And for me, you know, I just realized that I was never going to love farming, and I was never going to be very good at it. And in terms of putting my best effort into this fight, I thought I could do more work with my writing. And so here I am in the city, you know, I'm writing about causes that I find important. I was up at Standing Rock last year and wrote about that for Outside Magazine. And ironically, you know, I'm living a very urban life. I'm 4 blocks from my job. But what that means is I don't have to use a car very often.
Right.
And ride my bike. And I'm finding ways to sort of cut free from that consumption cycle right here in the city.
Right. It's possible. I think if there's a common thread I see in all three of these couples, is like I think you said in the introduction that a lot of them have kind of uncoupled or decoupled themselves from the food industry, from the energy industry, and perhaps even live just a smaller footprint and size of, let's say, their home or their car. They still may have a car, but they don't use it that much. So it's kind of uncoupling from the industrial,
right,
the industrial-based lifestyle. Do you see that in all three of those?
I do. And to different degrees, the folks out in Missouri have really done it. I mean, they don't use cars, they don't use any petroleum products, they don't use any electricity. And, you know, the folks in Montana, of course, they use tractors and they
right.
use trucks to get their vegetables to market. But in doing so, they're providing, you know, thousands of people the opportunity to change their diet from corporate California produce that ships 2,000 miles to things that are grown organically right in the Bitterroot Valley. So it's not all about purity, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And actually, when I went on my book tour and I meet lots of young, idealistic people who would really like to live a low-impact life, you know, I tell them that going off to a homestead in rural America might not be the best thing because of the petroleum required to get back and forth to schools or to the grocery store. And really, there's always these problems with isolation when you move out to your off-grid homestead.
Right.
And in some ways, cities provide these answers. You know, cities already have the density and they have the infrastructure. And if you can find a city where it's not too expensive, I mean, a lot of Midwestern cities are this way, and you don't need to have a car, like you're already much better off than people who are trying to do this out in the wilderness. Of course, a lot of cities are so expensive that you're hooked into some kind of soul-sucking job a lot of the time. But I think that there's great things happening in places like Detroit and St. Louis, and I'm here in Albuquerque. You know, cities that haven't been totally gentrified yet and made unaffordable to normal people.
My great example, I tell my friends that my buddy who lives on the Upper West Side of New York City, a family of four, has a smaller carbon footprint than I do.
My sister
myself,
gives me a hard time about the same thing.
Who lives out
in
here.
In Manhattan.
And it's primarily, right, in Manhattan, because that's where the sustainability lies in, like you say, Mark, in more dense settings that use common elements, common infrastructure.
Right.
And have a more economy of scale associated with their
livelihood.
The question is, do we want to live? Are we comfortable with wanting to live in dense, more dense settings? Well, those of us who live in Park City, the answer is no. I mean, most of us came from dense settings back east or so, or LA or Chicago. That's the challenge, but that's where the sustainability lies going forward.
I mean, I lived in Moab for 11 years, and so I grew up in L.A. So, and while I was in Moab, I really thought that I was living more simply and closer to nature and all that. And it's been a real sort of forehead smacking experience to realize that maybe I was more wasteful or consuming more by living in a place like Moab than I would if I was living in Salt Lake City, for example.
Yeah. So we got just a couple more minutes. If you have a couple more minutes, I got just a couple more questions. Is this a necessity going forward? Is this going to become more of a necessity in terms of 7.5 or by the end of this show, 7.6 billion people on this planet, that more and more of us really need to take this seriously, that we need to live a lifestyle that demands less of the planet and its natural resources? This is not going to be something that's just a one-off, a novelty. Is that a trend?
I do think so. I think that the resources are going to get more scarce. And, you know, Americans consume at a rate that has never been seen in the history of civilization.
Right.
People used to ask me with my other book, The Man Who Quit Money, about the guy living in a cave down in Moab. They said, Well, what if everyone lived like that? You know, who would teach school? Who would make clothes? Who would farm if everyone was just out in the cave? And I understand the question, but at the same time, I'm like, well, what if everyone lived like me? What if all 7 billion lived like me, and we would need 3.5 planets so that everyone could take a shower every day and have their own car? So it's, you know, we're kind of heading towards a cliff, and we're saying, well, everything's fine, right? but it's not. And this is not a sustainable future. I guess I would just add one other thing, is that the purpose of both these books is not to make everyone feel guilty and say, oh, you're doing wrong, but I was actually able to find people who had found lifestyles that they found meaningful. So, again, it's not about just using less. It's about finding a life that means something to you, and often the cycles of waste and consumption are really tied into a feeling of spiritual bankruptcy, of hopelessness or meaninglessness. And so both of these books are not just like a scold of like, oh, you need to use less, but more of a positive thing of, hey, can you find a way to live that you find fulfilling?
Exactly. Along those same lines, do the people you feature and talk with about these lifestyles, do they feel like they're doing something radical, or do they feel like they're doing the only thing that makes sense?
Right.
I would definitely say it's the second. I mean, they think that everyone else is radical. And, you know, they're saying, like we're doing what makes us happy. And they get 1,000 people a year who come up to them, whether if they're visitors at the Possibility Alliance, which is a place in Missouri, or they're customers at the farmer's market. And these people say, God, I wish I could do what you're doing. I wish I didn't have this mortgage and this job and this commute and this feeling of isolation in where I live. And they hear that all the time, and they look at these people like, and they say, well, you can. I mean, we're doing it.
Right.
You know? Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, they think it's funny that I call them radical in this book, because they're like, we're just doing what makes sense to us, and what we're just following our heart and doing what we love.
Right. And that's an interesting point, because typically you think of these people who are off the grid. They're kind of loners, survivalists. They're out in the middle of nowhere. These people are living amongst a community, and they don't come across as the survivalist type.
Or isolated, that,
even. Or isolationist.
Yeah. And, you know, when I first got this book under contract, I thought that those were the people I was going to write about, the Unabomber types or the hermits. And I quickly lost interest, and because to me that doesn't necessarily emotionally sustainable to cut off ties with your family and the rest of humanity and go, you know, eat your beef jerky in your cabin. Like, that wasn't what I wanted, and that didn't seem like a sort of positive role model for aspiring environmentalists. So I found these people, they all have children, and they all have community, and they all do work that they love. And I thought, well, this is the model, even if they're not completely pure in terms of not using any industrial product.
Well, we can all at least strive, even in Park City, to be a little more unsettled, we'll call it, or uncoupled from
sure,
that,
sure.
From those industrialized complexes, like we say, whether it's the food industry and the energy industry and the development industry, or however you want to classify it. And the one I always kind of harp on is the fact that, you know, we care about eliminating plastic bags here. We have a plastic bag ban, and that's great. That's admirable. And we do our best to drive our Priuses
electric
and our
high vehicles.
Electric, and that's great. Although in this state,
right.
It's still coal and natural gas powered, but those are goals. But when it comes to food, oh my goodness, we are horrible, because we live in a food, let's face it, it's kind of a food desert up here. Everything's imported, 95%.
Right.
And until as a community, get comfortable with the idea that it's okay not to have pineapples on our shelves at our 5 full-service supermarkets in this town 12 months out of the year, you know, we're not helping things. And until we go back to a lifestyle, and that's in some ways what these people do, all they're doing is living a lifestyle that maybe my grandparents lived. It's not that far away.
Right.
You know.
No, no.
But that's
and
where...
And it's certainly not that far from the rest of the world.
Mm-hmm. No, yeah. But it's a good point, Mark, because India and China, all 3.3 or 3.5 billion of them, look at us with envy. And they, what's their goal and objectives in life? They want to live a middle American life like we do. You know, many of them are just looking for a refrigerator that works 24 hours a day, or an air conditioner.
Right.
You know,
sure.
But that's where the next consumption lies, and where all the impacts are, and that's another book. Sorry, Mark, but anyway, we really appreciate you taking the time to chat with us this morning. The name of Mark's book again is "The Unsettlers: In Search of the Good Life in Today's America." He's also the author of another great book, "The Man Who Quit Money," and that's a story about a guy in Utah, right, who lived in a cave, among other things.
That's right. Yeah, Daniel Suelo. He's a longtime resident of Moab, and he spent many of those years living in a cave not far from town, and sort of went on this path of religious renunciation. He wanted to live like the prophets, see if that was actually possible, if that was just a myth from the Bible and the other holy texts. Mm-hmm. And he found that he actually could live a life based on faith, on believing that the universe would provide if he could give up his attachment.
Almost kind of, yeah, so there's a moral or a religious attachment or aspect to living a simpler life in that way. So that's...
It is, and Daniel points out that all of the world's religions were started by people who lived this way, whether it was Jesus or John the Baptist or Muhammad or Buddha. It was people who, have to separate ourselves from the fruits of our labor, which is to say, don't do anything because you think you're going to get a reward. Do something because it's in your heart, and find the love that, that follows with that. And of course, that's totally antithetical to capitalism, which is always about doing something in order to get a reward from it.
Exactly. Well, hey, looking forward to your talk this Saturday at the Jim Sandy Auditorium here in Park City, Saturday the 23rd. I believe it starts around 6 p.m. Go to the Utah Humanities website to get the details on Mark Sundin's talk here in town about his book, The Unsettlers, and all the other works he's done, all the other books and works he's done for Outside Magazine, among others. Mark, it's been a great joy to chat with you, and we'll hopefully see you Saturday night.
Thanks. It's been great to be here, and I'm looking forward to seeing you all in Park City this weekend.
All right. Thanks again.
Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
Let's take a quick break for some underwriters and some sponsors. And when we come back, we got a bunch of news items to cover. Like we said, hurricane-related news.
National Monument-related.
National Monument-related news. Oh, boy. And Nels-related news about
Perfect.
Her trip in the Adirondacks. It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Tom Pettigrew from Park City Mountain and a proud supporter of KPCW. From kids' rope courses to zip lines and hiking trails to the bike park, Park City offers a wide range of family-friendly activities all summer long. More information on new summer activities and all the other programs can be found at parkcitymountain.com.
Dr. Bob Miller here from Miller Orthodontics, proud supporter of The Local View with Randy Barton, who makes us all smile. Embrace is a technology to straighten teeth without anything showing. More information about Embrace is at myembrace.com.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And we have some breaking news here, thanks to Ethel Preston. We're getting calls about a big accident on I-80 eastbound, and it's in Parley's Canyon, and it's just before Parley Summit. And so I-80 is down to one lane, and it's really backed up.
And it's raining really hard.
And it's raining really, really hard. Exact quote. And there are rescue vehicles on the site, and it's like starting to be cleared. But you should anticipate some delays, or you know, if you're waiting for people that are coming up from the valley, they may need a little extra time this morning.
Right. So there you go, all you settlers.
All of us in
See
our
what
cars.
Happens?
Yeah.
In the cars. Did we blame the earthquake on that too?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Where
earthquake
were you for that?
Related. So we were all, you know, my coworkers and I were all in my office or in our office, and I was on a phone call and I had my door closed and I walked out and everyone else was like, did you feel the earthquake?
Really?
I was the only person that missed it.
You what?
Yeah. Everybody else felt
That's because you work in that hardened bunker without.
It's because I was so focused on my phone call.
All right. That too.
That's what that's what we'll say.
Well, I felt the whole thing. I was totally unfocused. I was working, but open to anything to take
yeah,
my
any
attention
distraction.
Away. And I heard first a rumble. I actually heard a sound, you know, kind of a thunder, distant thunder rumble. And that lasted maybe a second and a half. And then my whole unit just kind of creaked, shook. Huh. It didn't vibrate. It just shook. It was, but it didn't sway either. I mean, it lasted again 2 seconds. The whole place just kind of swayed and creaked, more creaked than sway. And that was it. But I knew, having experienced a few when I lived in California, like that was an earthquake. That wasn't a truck or some other type of construction equipment or you know, a nuclear explosion or something like that. That was an earthquake. And then it took 20 minutes of just kind of inquiring, looking around until somebody else confirmed that indeed it was 3.3.
It was a 3.3 magnitude earthquake right near Murdoch Peak. So, I mean, really close.
Close.
So really small, but really close.
I don't know how if they determine how deep it was. I haven't read anything about that yet. But unusual, obviously. First one I've experienced in 11 years that I've lived here.
Me too.
So.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Okay, here's the depth. It was 8 miles beneath the Wasatch Mountain. So eight miles down is where that earthquake originated.
Wow. We should get somebody on who really knows what they're talking about that say tell us if that's deep or shallow or if there's a fault there.
We should. We'll work on that for next week.
Good. All right. So there's your environmental. Yep. There's your geological news.
Geologic update. That's earth science. It still counts.
It does. And so let's turn to a couple of items in the news. You want to do the – which one do you want to do? The hurricane first?
Well, I think we should start by talking about the updates on the national monuments and what's going to take place there.
The latest breaking news. This came out of the Washington Post, who actually got a copy of this document from the Department of Interior, which is suggesting that 4 national monuments be reduced in size and another 6 have kind of operational changes made to them.
Okay. And so this, of course, includes a couple here in Utah, both Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante. And I would say that those are no surprise. I think that everybody knew those were kind of in the sights.
Yep.
As well as Nevada's Gold Butte and Oregon's Cascade Siskiyou.
Right. So there's no definitive number as far as the reduction goes. So we don't know all, but they will all be, I feel comfortable saying this. They will all be reduced in size in some form or another.
And then the other interesting piece of that is he also mentioned the only two marine national monuments, the Pacific Remote Islands and the Rose Atoll.
Yeah.
And so he kind of raised the same prospect for those. So
some reduction there? Because I also read that there's operational changes, management changes to 6, including the 2 you mentioned, Rose Atoll, Pacific Remote Islands, one on the Atlantic seaboard, the Seamount, Northeast Canyons and Seamounts in the Atlantic. It's about 200 miles east-southeast of Cape Cod. And those marine sanctuaries are going to have recommended operational changes, means fishing, basically, will be allowed
less
there
protection.
Where it's not. So less protect in that sense. And then another, 1, 2, 3, land-based monuments, Katahdin Woods and Waters, Rio Grande del Norte in New Mexico, and the Oregon Mountains Desert Peaks, also in New Mexico, suggested changes in their management activities. They're primarily with respect to ranching, grazing, and logging activities. So not changes in size per se, but changes in how they're run and operated.
And that kind of begs the question, what... What does it mean? What does that national monument designation mean if it's still being heavily used for resource extraction? You know, what does that bring to the table?
Right. And what precedent does it set for others to be modified? If these 10, why not the other? Now, apparently the others, I think there were 27 in total that were under review. These are the only 10 that will have some changes done to them. But that's right now. You know, you can't say that the others still might be in play later on or so. There might be changes made to others. Okay.
All bets are off, we think, on this front.
Yeah, that's the way you have to look at it. So we'll keep you posted as to whether or not, the actual numbers come out as far as the reduction in size of Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante. But right now, it's going to happen. All right. Let's take another break, real quick break, and we come back. You want to do maybe the hurricane or your little journey through the Adirondacks?
Sure.
What you discovered. It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back.
Support for KPCW programming has been provided by the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance, a nonprofit organization dedicated to protecting Utah's remaining Red Rock Wilderness lands. SUWA and Utah's Red Rock Wilderness need your support now more than ever. To learn more about how you can become involved, please visit the SUWA website at suwa.org.
Hi, I'm Courtney Johansson, owner of 350 Main Brasserie, and we are pleased to support KPCW. 350 Main is located in the historic Golden Rule Building at 350 Main Street and serves eclectic American cuisine. Open nightly at 5:30 p.m. Reservations, menu, and contact information at 350main.com.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. We got a few more minutes for a couple news items. Now you're in the Adirondacks doing some hiking, et cetera.
Yeah, but were you recently, actually.
Yes, I was. Yeah. I bagged a couple of peaks.
High peaks.
Is that what you call it?
High peaks. Yeah, quote unquote
hard hiking.
High peaks.
Believe me, it's hard hiking.
It is really hard.
There is no
it is
switchbacks
not, like,
in
it is
the
none of this cruisy Western hiking that we
it's
get here.
It's straight up, and while you're at it, go over these boulders.
Yeah, a little light bouldering,
and then
crossing some waterfalls.
That's equally as painful, if not more painful, coming down.
Yes, agreed.
That. Okay, so you were back there. What did you discover?
Yeah, so I was from that area, and there, for reference, in what's called the High Peaks region of upstate New York, there are 46 peaks above 4,000 feet,
mm-hmm.
which of course. Those of us here in Utah sounds a little bit laughable, but what you have to remember is that these are starting from just above sea level. So these are big peaks. For that area.
Many times you got to walk a few miles just to get to the trailhead, so they're quite remote.
Right, they're remote peaks. That's a good point, and it's challenging conditions hiking, and they're gorgeous, and they're one of my favorite places on earth. And on these 46 high peaks. There's something called the Alpine Zone, and it actually only exists on just under half of the high peaks, where there are specific these small islands of alpine vegetation that exists almost nowhere else except for high mountaintops in the Northeast.
Hmm.
And so there are things called, like, it's a type of wetland called a sliding fen or an alpine zone, you know, high meadow. And there will be like only 30 acres of this in existence total. And so the plants that grow there are really unusual. And my guess is that this is a relevant principle for many other mountain ranges. You get different things growing at the top in small isolated areas. But much like the Wasatch, the Adirondacks are starting to see a ton of use, people coming in from the surrounding areas to hike to the top and hang out in these gorgeous places. And a lot of damage was happening in those most critical zones right at the top of the mountains.
Mm-hmm.
And so they've put into place a new program called Summit Stewards. And that's not super new. They've had it in place for several years. And these are people whose job it is all summer long to hike to the top of certain high peaks and be there to educate people on what's going on how to decrease their impact, on how to avoid damaging the alpine zone, and they actively work on restoring it.
Really?
And I thought this was such a cool program because they're seeing the results, they're seeing restoration of these habitats, and I think it's something we might want to think about for some of our own peaks here. You know, think about climbing to the top of Timp. I mean, you're sharing it with like dozens of other people, or the alpine meadow below it. You know, maybe we need to talk a little bit more about how to protect some of these really heavily used in our own
and possibly
own environment,
extra sensitive areas or
at
unusual
the same time,
ever.
Extra sensitive. Yeah, yeah.
So in addition, like, it's kind of focused on plants,
mm-hmm.
but there might possibly be unusual varieties of insects.
Insects. There's wildlife that kind of
different types
specializes
of fungi
in those
so
areas.
Like that.
Ooh, I don't know about that one. I'll have to get the research team on it. But there are like these dozens of plants. There are 34 species in those alpine zones that are considered to be threatened or endangered.
And when people are
and there's only like 175 acres of this total.
Wow.
In existence, period.
That we know of.
That we know of,
so
right.
far. Okay. So that's really interesting. Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
So watch where you walk.
That's right.
And
stay on the rocks. Don't touch that alpine vegetation, those tiny little plants.
Stay on the rocks.
Those are the rules, Chris.
Summit Stewards.
That's right.
All right. That's, you know what? We got a few more minutes. Let's cover this hurricane story. Because this is interesting. It's obviously going to be ongoing, too. Both of us have visited the Keys.
Mm-hmm.
I used to live in Florida, so I used to go there quite a bit. The
yeah.
Keys got whacked in this hurricane from my friends who live down there.
Yeah,
there are certain stretches of the middle part of the Keys from, say, Marathon South, through Bahia Honda and Cujo Key and Big Pine Key, of course, decimated homes, structures, but also the wild, the vegetation.
So you're going to laugh when I say this, I know, but my mind went to the key deer, Chris. How are the key deer doing?
Not
well.
The
key deer, are they endangered species?
They are
tiny
endangered.
Tiny little deer that live only in the Florida Keys.
Right. And they took it on the chin, their key chin, too.
Their tiny little chin.
Yes. This is not to make too much of a joke, but they're troubled because obviously there are some of them who suffered physical harm during the storm trying to get away. But now their vegetation, their food source, is literally gone. These trees are denuded of vegetation, if not killed altogether. So their water sources are also perhaps contaminated
with salt water, I think.
Salt water, right.
Or that would be my guess. A lot of those freshwater sources now have salt water in them, and it'll take a while to kind of come back. So in the meantime, what are these poor little guys drinking, Chris?
Well, I don't know, but they among other lots of plant and animal species are at risk right now. And Chris, quickly running through, I mean, you have the silting and the sediment buildup that is in some of these little freshwater ponds around there, but also along the reefs, who are also kind of at risk because of bleaching activity to begin with prior to the storm. So you have that. You have all the garbage and junk and destruction that is now, you know, look at every photo. The canals are full of wood and plastic and other the detritus from all these damaged homes and infrastructure now on the water, on the canals and the surrounding waters. You have opportunities for invasive species to come in. We always talk about that. You damage an area,
any
create
kind
a void.
Of disturbance like that.
And then so invasive species, plants, animals, insects could come in and damage.
So are there folks that are focusing on assessing that? I know obviously so much of the focus is on how to make sure people are safe and that people's homes, you know, are coming back and utilities. But are there people assessing this environmental damage right now?
Department of Environmental Protection, Wildlife Resources there are doing what they can. And we'll cover that a little more, but we're out of time.
We got to wrap up.
But I got to play this. We got to come back just to wrap up. It's This Green Earth.
This is Ryan Hoffman, manager at Mountain West Bank, sponsor of KPCW. We're a community bank with a great understanding of our local needs. Mountain West Bank has something unheard of nowadays, but I can't say it on the radio. We're next to the movies near Kearns Boulevard at 649-3369. Division of Glacier Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Cookies on Fridays.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by AMA Waterways and Park City Air Cruise and Travel, 565-4730, parkcityaircruiseandtravel.com, Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, lrw-law.com, Fred Marshall Painting, painting Park City's home since 1974, fredmarshallpainting.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Time to wrap things up on This Green Earth. Let's thank our sponsors and underwriters who make the show possible. They include Recycle Utah,
Republic Services,
Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance,
Vail Epic Promise,
Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties,
San Francisco Design.
Who else? Park City Mountain.
And most importantly,
yes,
listeners like you.
Yeah, of course, you can join us on Facebook at KPCW This Green Earth.
Or email us what you want to hear on our show at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
Again, thanks to Mark Sundin. He's going to be here Saturday at the Santee Auditorium talking about his book, The Unsettlers.
Remember, this is KPCW 91.7 FM Park City. We've got your Wasatch back.